Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello and welcome to the Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the author of Phantom Orbit, a great new novel, and associate editor and columnist for the Washington Post, David Ignatius. No one covers foreign policy and writes about it better than David. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Now, before we get started, we want to reiterate some exciting news that we have. James and I are taking Politics War Room live to the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 19th and the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta on October 12th. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour. That's politicon.com/tour. And we can't wait to see you there. Get text updates about what's next, Politicon and Politics War Room, by signing up at politicon.com and tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the link to our sponsor, Miracle Made. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, we did, I don't know, maybe as many as 8 fabulous podcasts at the Democratic Convention. You can check them out, as we said, in our Substack site. But this is our first regular program since Chicago. That was my 24th convention, and to my surprise, one of the best. Democrats achieved almost all the goals, terrific speeches by the Obamas and the Clintons. They showcased their great farm club, some emotional moments. The fear of disruptive protest didn't happen, said he did a good job. And better than average acceptance speeches from the vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz. And I think Kamala Harris really rose to the occasion. You know, I spent an hour or so on the convention floor over a couple nights. And the delegates and the people I talked to, they were exuberant. Now, I think what that reflected is just a month earlier, they thought the national ticket was dead. Trump was going back to the White House, and now they saw a real chance. And talking to politicians in states, the Biden team had basically written off Georgia, Arizona. They really had optimism. And North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper told us out there that he thinks his state has a real chance to go Democratic in a presidential election for the first time since 2008. I think, and I want you to really join this, I think there was one missing element. Kamala Harris has yet to explain her 2019 campaign, why she no longer believes some of those left-wing positions she took, doing away with private health insurance, minimal border controls, banning fracking. She made clear that she doesn't hold those views anymore. She heartily embraced a bipartisan tough border bill. She's for expanding the Affordable Health Care Act rather than Medicare for All. But she needs to explain these changes. She was VP. She learned a lot. They're more realistic. And she'll have that opportunity tonight with CNN's Dana Bash, a good reporter who asked tough questions of Harris and Walz, and then the September 10 debate with Trump. But when you think about doing this show, 5 weeks, 6 weeks ago, James, it looks a lot better today.
Yeah, Harris is going to have to address 2019. The convention would have not been the right place to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just what you're telling your story and you got attention and you should be saying all good stuff. It's not a place to get in an argument with yourself, but I'm sure she's going to get asked about it tonight. I don't have any doubt about it. She's going to have to answer it, and I hope she has a encompassing answer that takes every one of these things, because it is an absolute truism of American politics that anybody that ever listens to a single thing that the identity left ever says is left to regret it. It just is. It's just a fact. And she said some things that she's going to have to answer for. I think she can. I don't think it's fatal. I think a bad answer would hurt a lot, but I think she probably can have a good answer. It, you know, we'll go from there, and then she's going to be on with Walt. So she can give a good answer, and Walt can come back about all the hypocritical and crazy things Trump has said. But she's got to answer it. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, that's her. That's the big challenge. I frankly think she's. I would if I were a betting man, James. I wouldn't have bet on the Washington Nationals last night, but I would bet on. I would. That hurts. I know. That's an inside joke.
I was so sure that Jared Cogart by -240 in. Patrick Coleman, I thought he was Walter Johnson, man.
Anyway, if I were a betting man, I like her odds in that debate. I really think she'll do very well in the debate. But, you know, she has to do well in that interview beforehand. But, you know, turning to that other side, the Trump side, James, I mean, the political – remember 6 weeks ago, they were talking about winning Virginia, Minnesota, New Hampshire. You don't hear any of that anymore.
They weren't the only people talking about it.
Right.
Oh. The Democrats were talking about it.
They were worried about it. And those are off the boards now. And Trump is still off balance. As you've noted, those crying for him, the Lindsey Grahams or Squiggly Tea Biscuit, whatever he's called, say, talk policy. He doesn't have any, except to say how bad the other guys were or drill, baby, drill. He can get those Arizona temperatures up to 150. And let me just take one, and then you can, you know, join the whole conversation. Abortion. He has had more positions than a Rubik cube. He bragged 2 years ago, I was the one that ended Roe v. Wade. Now he's saying that no, that women will do, women's, you know, reproductive freedoms will be great under me. I'm a champion of that. He'll say and do anything, and he's angry. I think he's going to have a big test on September 10th too, James.
Well, he does have policies. It's a big policy. And that's what we've talked about this, and you brought it up. Extending the tax cuts for people making over $400,000 a year. If you're in the top one-tenth of 1%, that amounts to around $750,000 in tax cuts a year. Does anyone really believe that's what we need in this country?
Right.
Go after him. His tariff stuff, there was some excellent economic studies on just what that would do to consumer prices in the United States. So I wouldn't say that he has no policies. I would say that he has just god-awful policies. And as you also point out, the extension of the subsidies for health insurance, for Obamacare are coming up. And while we're talking about the referendum in Florida, on the abortion referendum, Peter Werner, I hope I'm pronouncing
it right. Peter Werner.
Peter Werner. Pointed out something that is demonstrably true. The pro-life movement in the United States is totally full of shit. Total. That forever and ever and ever they've been talking about whether that abortion is in any sense or form is murder. And you just got to understand it. That was a claim that deeply held view. I can't tell you that bad people would hold that point of view. Other people like myself said it's more complicated human problem than that. All right. Now, they don't even say that anymore. And Trump is talking about he may vote against. He's going to say he's going to vote against the Florida six or whatever the vote, the six-month ban. And they're fine with that. And now they're saying, well, we're going to leave it to the states. Well, if you think it's murder, if that was what you told people for 50 years, then stand up and do it. And they're just shown to be nothing but a pack of frauds.
And they're going to let him get away with it. I assure you, James, that there will be meetings of some of those evangelical and some of those anti-abortion activists, and Trump will send people there privately, they hope, and say, hey, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it, you know, in January, February next year. You know, we got the Comstock Act in our back pocket. We can have the FDA ban medication pills. You know, we're going to cut back a lot. Just don't give us a hard time between now and now and the election.
Right. Don't tell. They're not. They've lost all. There's nothing. They'll never get it back. They've lost any perceived moral high ground that they ever had. And I know plenty of people that are pro-life, and they they've always convinced me that they genuinely believe that. And you can convince, not the leadership of the pro-life movement. You're just a bunch of greedy, power-hungry people that are willing to do anything so you can hang out on an expense account in Washington.
They're all emulating Ralph Reed, who really cares about humping for money, as he once put it. That's what it's all about, and access and influence. But no, I think you're absolutely right. And just to pick up on 2 points you raised, the Affordable Health Care Act, those subsidies expire next year. Now, when Trump ran against it in 2016, they weren't very popular. Now they are overwhelmingly popular. What's Trump going to do? Well, I'll tell you what he says. He says, do away with the Affordable Health Care Act, as Barack Obama pointed. He doesn't call it Obamacare anymore because it's so popular. But he won't tell us what he's going to do. He had 4 years to do something, 2 years of which he controlled all the Congress. That's because he has no idea. It's just to him a convenient political issue. And same thing with those tax cuts. People making over $400,000, you have a choice. You're going to give them an extension of the tax cut, as you say, $750,000 for the richest 0.1%, or you're going to take a chunk of that money and use it for child tax credit and reduce poverty, a chunk of that money and use it for a couple other programs, and a chunk of that money and use it for deficit reduction. That's a good argument Donald Trump doesn't want to have.
No, he's not going to have that argument. And hopefully that they bring it up at the debate.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's like, when's Harris going to sit down and do? All right, she's doing it. That whole thing is just annoying. And now I say, well, she's having walks, so maybe she should do this. You're never going to satisfy. So just do what you want to do. Do the thing with Dan and Bash. You want to do something else, do something else. But understand, there's nothing you're going to do that's going to satisfy. Oh, she needs to answer more. She needs to do this. She needs to do that. And you know, bring it up at the debate on September 10th. A lot's going to be brought up.
Yeah, no, I think overconfidence would be a huge mistake. It's still likely to be a pretty close election. But as of late August, rather have her hand than his.
So the big question, since Nate Silver, how much of, I think Washburn, you said, says you need to win a popular vote by 2. Some people say that. I didn't see it yet, but somebody said that Nate Silver kind of downgraded a little bit because she's got to win by 4. I don't know. I'm just taking a consensus number. It's 3.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do know that Trump underpolled in 2020 in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan in particular. I mean, really underpolled. So there's a lot to be nervous about. Don't get me wrong. I haven't said all of that. He just looks stale. I'm sorry. And I'll get, you know, maybe he can get it back. But he's not very potent anymore, I don't think. I really don't. Now, this Labor Day weekend coming up, the things he can do to regain his potency, I'll be clear about that. But right now, I'm unimpressed.
Well, I told you, coming back from taking my kid home a couple of weeks ago, I drove through a rural section of Maryland, which is, you know, mainly Trump country. And I remember certainly 8 years ago and maybe 4 years ago, but certainly 8, there were Trump signs on about every third yard. I only saw one over about a mile and a half stretch. Now maybe that's not an indicator, but it says something.
Yeah, it's in Shenandoah County, Virginia, there was 7 Trump signs between Highway 11 and my place. Now there's none. I've heard the same thing on Highway 1 in Louisiana, on Baia Lafourche. There used to be 35 or 40 of them, and now there's 3.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who had family in Ohio went to see his wife's family, and said it used to be flooded with Trump signs, and I forgot the name of it. It was Red County, Ohio. I said, I didn't see all the any. And I don't know what it means, but you got 4 different pieces of anecdotal evidence. It's got to mean something. You know, sure, there shouldn't mean Senator County is going to be blue. But
if if there is an enthusiasm gap that now maybe slightly favors the Democrats, that may be one of the reasons he overperformed in some of those states last time, as you noted, because his enthusiasm was greater. If that's changed, he may be less likely to overperform. But we'll
see. What I'm doing is, look, I'd rather be her than him. I'll be clear about that. What I'm trying to do is just put objectively what people should be looking at.
Right, right.
And right. I think he might have lost some mojo here. I hope he did. But we'll see.
Okay. We got now till November 5. We're going to have so much to talk about. So stay tuned. Hey, James, we welcome back America's premier foreign policy columnist and prolific author of The Washington Post, David Ignatius. David, your journalistic expertise on the Middle East is unsurpassed. And I know you've written that neither Iran nor Israel want a major war. And the Hezbollah retaliation was controlled. Yet it remains a tinderbox with daily incidents. Predictions are always hazardous in the Middle East, but how do you assess the odds today of first a Gaza truce deal and avoiding a major confrontation?
Al, one of our Wall Street Journal colleagues told me years ago that when it comes to the Middle East, pessimism pays.
Right.
That's still true. But having said that, I think that U.S. mediators are very close, finally, to a Gaza truce, and with that would come a de-escalation, certainly with Hezbollah. There's a likelihood that there'd be finally some version of the UN agreement, Security Council resolution passed years ago that would contain things at the border. De-escalation, I think, also with Iran. The problem is that every time, it's like Zeno's paradox, you go halfway toward the goal each time, but you never get there. And as close as we are now, events like today's Israeli operations in the West Bank destabilize the situation, make it hard for the Arab mediators and for Hamas to appear to be knuckling under to pressure. There's always a question as to whether Prime Minister Netanyahu really wants a ceasefire deal or just thinks it's in his political interest to keep this war going. But in simple answer to your question is, a deal is near. They're down to bargaining small details, the names of individual Palestinian prisoners who'd be released, the particular points at which Israeli troops might remain on the border strip between Gaza and Egypt. But it's going to take a clear yes from Hamas, a clear yes from Netanyahu, and then the whole apparatus that's in place, thanks to the U.S. mediation, goes forward.
Let me pick up on your observations about Netanyahu. I think it's his first priority is self-preservation. He wants to stay in office and stay out of jail. Can he agree to a deal and still keep his right-wing coalition together?
Probably not. I mean, I think one assumption is that this deal would indeed force Netanyahu to make a new coalition. Many, many months ago, my late friend, the wonderful Middle East analyst, former American ambassador, Martin Indyk, said the goal of U.S. policy was to make Bibi either choke on the frog or swallow the frog. The frog meaning all the complicating aspects of this deal. Clearly, some of Netanyahu's right-wing partners would not accept the terms of what the U.S. is proposing, and the coalition would fall. It's one part of the strategy is that the Knesset is now on recess. It won't be back until the end of September, which means that there's a window of a month in which you can move forward, have a month of truce, perhaps acclimate Israel to a new reality. Humanitarian aid flows in. It's just a different situation. You've moved off the X. If Netanyahu takes it, he would be assuming he could form a new coalition in that period without the right wing. But there's no question that the right wing would refuse to accept the terms that are now on offer.
David, they are the most powerful military in the region. They've been the Israelis, but they can't fight Hamas, the Houthis, Hezbollah, and possibly Iran without major American assistance. So President Biden, who hopes this could be his, I guess, final big achievement if they're successful, is he able, if it gets to the sticking point at the end, can he apply pressure, more leverage on Bibi that would make it very difficult for Netanyahu to refuse?
I've asked that question often, and the answer I get from senior officials is, even if we were prepared to try, what would in effect be regime change in our Israeli democratic ally, there's no evidence that we'd be very good at it. Israelis are in disagreement about many aspects of policy. Netanyahu has a lot of enemies, but one thing Israelis agree on is they don't want the United States telling them what to do. So I think there's every likelihood that would blow up when Biden's really modest step to limit the shipment of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel was leaked in the Israeli press. You know, there was an explosion of Israeli anger and resentment. So I think that's a tricky one. Over the longer term, Al and James, I think it's important for the United States to think about its relationship with Israel. It's not a tenable situation in which any ally forces its senior partner into policy decisions that may not be in the senior partner's security interest. So people need to look really carefully at that in the after-action reports. There's going to be so many things that people look at about this war, some more serious, obviously, for Israel. But this is one that the U.S. needs to think about.
Let me ask you one final question before turning it over to James, and that's Iran. You've written that they do plan retaliatory actions of some sort against the United States. Same time, you hear reports that they even talk about rejoining the nuclear deal, or at least discussions about that. They have a new president. Has the situation changed in Tehran at all?
Well, I think the fundamentals haven't. We still have a clerical regime with the IRGC as its sword and shield that's as ruthless as ever. But it's possible that Iran may be on a different tactical course. Iran feels isolated. Iran has responded to U.S. messages, and they've been extensive. People don't realize that over the last 9 months or so, there has been regular, fairly deep back-channel diplomacy between the U.S. and Iran, sometimes in person, to talk about red lines, parameters for the conflict, ways of preventing de-escalation. And generally, it's been successful. It's interesting. I think U.S. officials would say that back channel is working. I do think maybe this regime of the new president does want to go back into nuclear negotiations. It's not to say that we're looking at Iran where the fundamentals are different, but the tactics may be different. I've always thought it was a big mistake to get out of the nuclear deal. If we can get back into a nuclear deal, it caps them short of having a bomb. Good. I think it's worth doing.
James.
So David, you said something I found interesting, that the Israelis don't like to get advice from the United States. Okay, since Camp David, how much assistance do you think the United States has provided the State of Israel?
I'm going to guess it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars. I'm just guessing here, but it's a whole lot.
Right. So you want our money, but you don't want our advice, which is a kind of unique position to be in. And you have a well-earned reputation of being very knowledgeable and kind of even-handed in your analysis in the Middle East. Do you have any justification for these jackass settlements in the West Bank?
So I've thought and have written for decades now, James, that I think settlements are the obstacle to the kind of peace that will bring Israel greater security, prosperity. I think the settlements and the ever-continuing expansion, the illegal outposts that precede settlements, the raids by settlers who come down from the hilltops and maraud in Palestinian villages. I traveled the West Bank in December and did a lot of reporting on the ground about this problem. And if we're ever going to talk seriously about a resolution of this problem with something like a Palestinian state, first, there's not a lot of land left. It's what West Bank's really kind of a map of Swiss cheese with so many holes in it because of settlements. But even so, it could be done if the settlers could be kept in check. And you know who is the most important preventive force in keeping the settlers from running wild? It's the IDF. It's the Israeli military. The Israeli military, in my experience, many of their commanders hate the settlers. They find them a menace. Suppose your job was to keep the lid on in the West Bank, and you had these people coming down from the hilltops at night with masks on and just wrecking havoc, always threatening to torch the stable accommodation that you were trying to work out. You'd be pretty angry at them. So, you know, it's a final point. You know, a lot of complicated things about our relationship with Israel, but I, through this war, I've had a chance to talk to a lot of senior IDF generals, the leaders of their internal security service, the Shin Bet. These are people of the highest quality. They're great allies for the United States. They're responsible. They're trying. They would have brought this war to an end months ago if they'd been able to, I think.
So I remember when I was in Israel a lot at the end of the last century. I'd talk to policy people, defense people, and stuff like that. And everybody would say, James, you got to understand, this is our equivalent of slavery. That we don't know how to get rid of it, but we know it's not going to end very well. I'm not equating that to settlers anyway, like slave owners. But it was just that there was this intractable problem that in effect is going to bite us on the ass one day, but we don't have the political will to deal with it. But I thought it was kind of interesting. And that was 25 years ago. I mean, people knew it. So I read your piece on Congressman Mike Gallagher today, and I'd known who he was, and he's in the Marine Corps. I've been with Palantir for over 10 years now. I think he's a very good hire for them. Is he going to endorse in this race?
I don't think he's going to endorse. I think that's the opposite of what he's trying to do now. He's trying to get a little distance from politics and start a new career with a first-rate tech company. But,
right.
You know, as you know, James, Mike Gallagher is an example of the kind of people we need in Congress, and he's also an example of how difficult it is to be a responsible Republican in the House now. I mean, you know, the stuff he went through trying to do the people's business sensibly makes you sick. So, you know more about this than I do.
I know, but there are people like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and Michael Luttig. There are people that say, this is too far. I'm going to vote for Harris. Okay,
yeah.
I believe, as we said on the show, this is an existential threat to the Constitution, that these guys get in there, and the idea that you have these principled people that say, well, I don't want to be part of this, but I'm not going to say anything, I don't know. I'm not there. I think somebody's got to say something here.
It's a fair point. You know, the real profile and courage is when you step out and you take risks to do the right thing. I'll give Gallagher credit. He refused, under a lot of pressure, to vote for the impeachment of Alan Mayorkas, which, of all the farcical things that the
right.
Republicans have done in the House, that's high on the list. And he took a lot of heat for it, but he did the right thing. There are other examples of that, but how's he going to vote in November? I have no idea. But your question
that's
is,
a controversial question.
Will he publicly endorse Harris? And I would think the answer to that would be no. That's not where he is.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Carl. But, you know, but in World War II, we didn't say, well, Tojo came from more humble backgrounds than Roosevelt did we? We weren't trying. I mean, this is to me, this is where we are. Your point, this is the whole goddamn country's at risk. And the point I made, David, I would tell Gallagher the same thing. If you want your party back, if you believe in a blow tax, lighter regulatory touch, more nationalistic, stand straight at the anthem, or whatever it is. You're pulling for one thing this November, a fucking wipeout, like a Goldwater, okay? Because what happened, they got wiped out in 64. What did they do in 68? They won. The Democrats got wiped out in 72. What did they do in 76? So I would say to Mike Gallagher, if Harris gets 280 electoral votes, you're not getting your party back. It's not coming back. The only way that it comes back is that you have to get annihilated in this election. And then I'd say that to Bill Kristol, Tim Miller, or any of my other friends. I said to my wife and her friends, you want to get wiped out. If you really want your party back, if you love that Republican Party, you ain't getting it back with Harris getting 280 electoral votes, I promise you.
You put it just right. Trump cult needs to be burned out of the Republican Party if you're going to have a Republican Party again. As you two are the experts, and you know that there's an argument we're in the midst of a change in our party system, like we've had in the past in our history, where parties in the end disappear. The old Republican Party may be disappearing, becoming a populist party that's just very different, has no place in the end for Mike Gallagher, and that's the decision he'd have to make, and some of these other Republicans. But you're right. If we want to go back to a version of the party system we had before, Trump has to lose catastrophically, so badly that people say, that's it, it's over.
Right. And that may not even be possible, but that's what they need to have it.
Yeah, I thought your Gallagher piece was fascinating. We've had a number of times on this program, we've had Raja Krishnamoorthy, who was the Democratic counterpart, and they both had... One was a progressive Democrat, one was a conservative Republican, but they had a lot of mutual respect and work well together in that shiny thing. The one thing I disagree with his analysis is he really calls for a less powerful speaker and committees. I don't think the House works with 435 speakers, but he's obviously a thoughtful man. He belongs in Congress. It's a shame he left, and it was a good piece, David. Let me ask you two quick questions about Ukraine. Their foray into Russia seems to have clearly rattled Putin, although he responded with a massive attack on Ukrainian civilian infrastructure. Is Zelensky achieving enough to at least start thinking about getting to a negotiating table with a better hand? And on the other hand, are the Russians still confident time is on their side, especially if Trump were to win in November?
So I think the Russians are still confident. They're slow starters, but they do have staying power. I think there's no chance that Putin, thinking there's a good possibility he'll be dealing with Trump, who would want to broker what would be essentially a concessionary peace agreement in favor of Russia, wouldn't want to wait that out. So I think that's a problem. Zelensky was an increasing political difficulty in Kyiv. I've seen that in my last two visits this year. And he needed to do something to get Ukrainian political support going again. And, this is a dramatic, lifts the spirits, a show of Ukrainian determination. He's got a lot of prisoners now that he could trade. I think the Russians probably would want to trade for prisoners. That would start a round of diplomacy that would make possible sometime next year, maybe, if Harris wins, a diplomatic resolution of the war. Zelensky's talking in those terms. I think that the fundamental difficulty is that neither side yet is really willing to give up on its basic goals. I mean, you don't have peace agreements until the parties are exhausted, until the ground is drenched in blood. It's an awful way to put it, but that's just the truth.
Yeah.
And it's getting that way. If the Russians, if the Russian forces in Kursk get cut off and those troops get annihilated, that's going to cause problems for Putin. There's a very interesting article in the paper yesterday saying that finally there's some measures that suggest that Putin's popularity in Russia is in decline. It's been up. He's more popular now than he was before the war. But that maybe that's beginning to change, and that would change the situation too.
Yeah. You know, I kept thinking that that foray into Russia, that was his kind of Doolittle raid. I mean, it was certainly a psychological boost, but that has maybe a short.
It was the Doolittle raid, and you know, another way to think about it, it's like General Lee's foray into Pennsylvania. You know, you wanted to do something that was tactically destabilizing, disruptive to the enemy. Problem is, you know, Civil War history turns on the results of that. The Battle of Gettysburg was a significant defeat for the Confederacy, and you could say it marked the beginning of the long end. The Union didn't fall up quickly enough, but I think that's the danger for what Zelensky's done is that it's a bold foray, but it leaves him open to potential difficulty down the road.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that David, how many novels have you now written?
I've written 12 novels. I'll tell the both of you. Sometimes I say to people, I've written 12 novels, and they'll say, "Do you write under a pen name?" Now that's embarrassing. They're not all. They haven't sold like Tom Clancy, but yeah.
Well, the latest one is Phantom Orbit. And any of our listeners out there ought to get it. David, your talents just never cease to amaze me. James, do you have anything you wanted to wrap this up?
Well, I guess I got one book because I've read a lot about this. I've thought a lot about it. I've talked to people about it. And I don't have a conclusion. Should Meade have pursued Lee after Gettysburg?
So that's a great question.
I just need an answer because I don't have. I've studied it and thought about it and replayed it and can't come up. Help me.
So I guess. Well, first response is, what do you think? You've thought about it.
I probably would not have. And yeah, I had a big, certainly a exhausted army, but Freshen and Lee's army. And Longstreet had set up perimeters. I mean, they were ready if they were going to come. But Lincoln was frustrated. You know, we had a chance. Yeah, Grant would have followed his ass.
Grant or Sherman would have followed his ass. You're absolutely right. And don't forget how mad Lee was at Longstreet. You know, right after Gettysburg. So it's a question we can keep asking. David Ignatius, you are a fabulous guest. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you both. Great conversation. Thank you.
Hey, James, now for the outrage of the week. Senator Tom Cotton charged that all those Republicans who spoke at the Democratic convention, former congressman, lieutenant governor of Georgia, Trump White House aides, that they're just guilty of Trump derangement syndrome. And besides, every campaign has people switching party allegiances. Now, maybe he can explain why not just switching party allegiances, but so many of those who served at the highest level in the Trump administration and knew him best, his former chief of staff, two defense secretaries, two national security directors, his head of the National Intelligence Agency, former secretary of state, and his own vice president, have said he's unfit for office and won't vote for him. Senator Cotton, that would be like in 2012, if Barack Obama, seeking re-election, if Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff, defense secretaries Robert Gates and Leon Panetta, Jim Clapper, head of national intelligence, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Vice President Biden all said Obama was unfit to serve. What would you think of that, Senator? This, of course, is unimaginable, except what we have now. And this doesn't even get into an intellectual luminary like former appeals court judge Michael Luttig, a conservative icon, who endorsed Harris, decrying that Trump would be a catastrophic threat, quote, catastrophic threat to the rule of law and American democracy. Sorry, Senator Cotton, there is nothing normal about a total no confidence vote from those who know him best.
Well, I think that pretty good what you said really brought it home. that, you know, how a good part of this party is splitting off of him. I think there should be more. I think some of them necessitate speaking out, but give credit to the ones that did. So for my outrage, he said there's certain things that we regard as human behavior, all right? And I'm not going to say somebody's not human. I mean, they got a face and they got limbs and they got motor skills and cognition skills. But there are people that it just seemed to me that forfeit any ability you might have to see them in somewhat favorable light for anything. And these are the people, one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life was the mocking of Governor Walz's son, Gus.
Oh.
Who, I mean, he just, the guy has a disorder, not totally unsimilar to what I have, or my oldest daughter has. So we're very sympathetic to that in our family. I'm sure you are too. And they started, Ann Coulter started mocking him. And then there's this guy, this subhuman is all I can call him, by the name of Jay Weber, who is a talk show guy in Milwaukee. And so I was reading this article in the iHeartRadio, and of course it kicked him off the air for a day or some bullshit. And this bullshit guy says, I lost my bearings. I'm a former teacher. I know never to make fun of teenagers. And then, of course, he did, when President Obama was in office, he literally was mocking his 16-year-old daughter. I don't think, and there's this New Jersey Republican called Mike Crispy. But I think this guy, Weber, I'd like to him, for him to answer just the question. Do you have human emotions? I mean, I know you sit there and run your fat fucking mouth all the time, Wisconsin radio. And what is it? What is it about these teenagers or young people that you want to continually mock? I just do not get it at all. And of course, this guy pontificates on everything. I'm sure he does. I would listen to him if you paid me to. But what a subhuman jerk.
Yeah, Ann Coulter joined that fray too.
Yeah, I got mentioned. Surprise. I mentioned that and gave her credit. And she said, well, I didn't realize that he had a issue. Of course you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Look, that kid was, you're so right. That kid was so charming. That was such a move. I mean, for that kid to stand up and say, that's my dad.
It was. And then he comes up on the stage, and then somebody, one of them, makes fun that Governor Walz put his hand out to help Gus, when in fact people that have this condition have spatial depth perception issues. God, these people are we know that Trump is not really, he's a subhuman for sure. He doesn't have emotions.
No.
That picture of him grinning in front of that Marine Staff Sergeant's grave. Oh, God, man, I don't know. What is wrong with these people?
You remember, James, back in, I guess it was 16, that there was a New York Times reporter who had disabilities. Trump mocked him. I mean, he imitated his disabilities.
It
was as cruel as you could possibly be. And I told my daughter, he's more like an animal. She got furious because she loves animals.
It's so funny. J.D. Vance, he's trying to be funny. Of course, he's not anything. In the cat lady quote, I've never seen things stick like that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I tell you that thing has penetrated. And he tried to make light of it and said, well, I apologize to cats. Okay. And it goes to show you. And I'd like to see the last, since the Republican convention, show me one photo of Trump and J.D. Vance together. All right, a single one. And he said that he and Bobby Kennedy was the strongest ticket ever.
I have to tell you that I've known the Kennedy family for a long time. I knew Bobby a little bit. He is really crazy. I mean, he is just, he ran one of the most, I don't know how to describe it, but just terrible. It was not just a bad campaign. A lot of people run bad campaigns. He's going to be known. His campaign is going to be known for the revelation that he got a bear, a dead bear, put it in the trunk of his car and dumped it in Central Park. I don't think that's what you want to be known for.
Or taking a severed whale's head and putting it on top of his car and driving around. I don't have. You can pick your friends. You can't pick your relatives. And
right.
Take care of the family. And the guy is just out of his mind. And he was started at 20. He ended up at 2. And he was going to, you know, as Paul Begala said, at this pace, he would have been -6 on election day or something. But I mildly feel sorry for his family that they got to answer to this, but don't worry, we all got relatives we got to answer for.
Yeah, I think there's just a sadness there, and it's a sadness not even so much for him, but for, you know, the grandchildren, the cousins, and they all, it's a huge family gets together, and that's going to create some strange. I don't think he's going to matter at all politically. I really don't. I think if he was down at 2%, half of those people will stay home. And, you know, close elections, so everything matters.
Josh Marshall quoted some quant that said it cost Harris 0.25%. I don't know, but you could look at it on Talking Points Memo. I find him to be usually reliable.
Yeah.
He can read anything where he's not trying to raise money from you.
Of course, that's about the margin that Trump carried Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in 2016.
Yeah, look, yeah. So, could it be? Could, it could.
Yeah.
It may not be laughing, but, you know, we'll see.
All right, James, as might be expected, our listeners really responded this week. They were tuned in last week. Hard to pick from a number of good ones, but let me try. We'll start with Tom in Denver, Colorado. This is down your alley, James. He said there seems to be a lot of dysfunction in the Florida Democratic Party and reluctance of national Democrats to invest in them. As a donor to the Democratic Senate candidate, as pal, it really gives me pause to throw money her way. Is it worthwhile?
The short answer is yes. And I would not have said yes in 2022. And the reason is, if you watch our show during the convention, is Nikki Freed, who's a former elected Democratic Agriculture Commissioner of Florida, has taken over the party. They're winning elections left and right. If you look at the latest data, both public and private data, Powell's probably within 2 of Scott, Harris probably within 4 of Trump. And what Nikki has done is we got rid of those stupid jackass primaries, and we started recruiting some good candidates. And it's paid off, and we've won a couple of big specials. We won a big special in the Jacksonville mayor's race. We won a big special in a off-state legislature race in kind of eastern Orlando.
School board races?
And school board, they got wiped out in school board.
Right.
DeSantis is done. All right. He is toast. He can't go back to the Trump people. The Moms for Liberty are getting slaughtered. Big flashpoint, people don't like book burners. Okay? They went all into that. I'm very reluctant to declare anyone's political career over, but DeSantis, you may be done, dude. You're just done. I don't know if you got a place to go. And, you know, the Democrats are going to have to make, by the way, Colin Allred. They're like 2 polls out. Colin's like within 2 of Cruz. Cruz is not 50. The Democrats are going to have to make a real, particularly in the Senate, financially, Florida and Texas are 2, you know, of the 3 most expensive states. They're probably 2 of them. And it's going to present some real challenges here for Democrats. And, you know, of course, the danger is you go all in and you spend a bunch of money and people say, well, I told you you couldn't do it anyway. You'd fall short. That's a – Florida and Texas are going to present some real interesting thing for Democratic donors and Democratic interest groups and everything else.
Well, James, let me – you know, if you're much better equipped to give Tom advice than I am. But I think what I would say is that if I were the Harris-Walz campaign, you know, I may put a little bit into Texas and Florida now, but hold off and see if it looks better and see how other things look, you know, like mid-October. But I would certainly invest in those Senate campaigns, pal. And I think, I mean, I saw Ted Cruz on Fox the other night, and he was nastier than usual, trying to attack Colin Allred, saying she's just like, he is just like Kamala Harris, weak and all that, a former professional football player and civil rights lawyer, by the way, and talking about character. Of course, when Ted Cruz talks about character, James, it may be worth remembering that Donald Trump called his wife ugly and said that his father probably was involved in the assassination of JFK. And then Ted, when it was necessary, just came sucking back to curry favor with him. So, Ted, don't talk about character. But, James, I think an investment in Allred and Powell at this stage is certainly worthwhile.
Well, all right, you got it's more than investment. It's a fucking load of money. But in Florida, you got some help because you have the choice referendum.
Right.
And let me tell you, these people can raise money. And you also have the weed referendum. And somebody stands to make a lot of money selling weed in Florida. And typically these people help turn out, quote, traditional Democratic constituencies, unquote. So there's going to be a lot of money being spent, not directly by the campaigns or the committees that should have a positive pull on Democrats in Florida. And that's part of the reason I feel a little more bullish about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I certainly think Colin Allred I think he's a better candidate than Beto O'Rourke. And O'Rourke came on a couple points.
I think he's a little more complete. And, you know, he comes where he's, you know, O'Rourke was very known in El Paso, which is by Texas standards, not one of the biggest areas. And Colin's well known in the Dallas-Fort Worth media market, which is probably a lot of them shorts.
And maybe Waco, too, as a Baylor football star.
As a football player. Yeah.
Tim in Newburgh, Indiana, asks, what strategy would you advise Kamala to follow in the debates, particularly her opening remarks, but also throughout? Look, I feel good about Kamala Harris in debates because I think Trump will become unhinged again. Just the sight of her will drive him crazy. I think she has to remain cool. Don't let him bait her. Her opening remarks has to mainly be about the future and contrasting the future with going back to the past and be upbeat. And have her own game plan. And when he interrupts or when he tries to throw out all kinds of wild charges, some personal and some many untrue, respond when necessary, but don't feel that that's your mission. Your mission is to tell people who you are and why you're about the future.
Yeah, I've been wrestling with certainly the future past dichotomy works. You can't use change versus more the same because it just doesn't work being a Biden vice president in the Biden administration. I'm beginning to think that the axis is kind of fresh stale. All right? You know, let's we got something fresh, something new, something different here. If you want to go back to what you had, something that's stale. Future past, but, you know, I'm about 20, he's about 2018, I'm about 2028. She's obviously going to have a good answer, and I think she will. On the border, she's going to need to have a good, compelling, forward-looking answer on cost of living. I think they're really some good things in that area. I mean, Powell's basically declared inflation is kind of over. Now, you know, what people will say, well, yeah, you know, a dozen eggs was $2, it went to $4, and now it's $3. But the Fed cut is going to help. And, you know, the Fed certainly has some confidence in the direction of the economy because they're getting ready to cut rates. So she's got some really good stuff here. And I think she's going to be well prepared. And I think he knows that he needs this. I don't think he's going to back out.
He won't.
He'll bitch about ABC and he'll piss and moan, but he will show up.
Yeah, he's trying to work the refs ahead of time, which he always does.
can be pretty successful at it. It's not, he doesn't have, he's got some success because, oh, we just want to be objective. We just, and believe you and me, ABC is going to go out of his way to be objective and fair.
Well, I don't mind that, but, don't play on his turf. I suspect they won't. James, Frank in Avon, Indiana. We have two straight Indiana questions. Man, good. We're big in Hoosier land. Says that the recent Democratic convention, we were privy to the deep well of the Party for Futures. Boy, we sure were. Who are there? Who, he wants to know, James, are the up-and-coming strategists? Who are the James Carvilles of the 20s and 30s?
Thank you for the flattery. We had the Gerstein and all those young posters that he had. The guy I particularly like is Eric Heyer. He was Beshear's campaign manager. He's done a bunch of races. His wife is really involved in politics, and he's an actual campaign manager, of which I've always been a little partial to. But I would certainly put Eric at the top of the kind of rise. Oh, look, our friend Quentin Folks.
I was going to say Quentin
and
Folks.
I saw something about Quentin and Harris. He's got Harris in doing something interesting. They're going in these red counties in Georgia, and Quentin says we're doing that because we got to lose them by less. As you know, we at Bridge did that in 2020 in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. We're doing it again. The idea is to work in places that you're going to lose, but right. Instead of losing them 85-15, lose them 75-25, and that's solid strategy. So I would definitely put Quentin in the top rank of up-and-comers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, I guess, the number, three person maybe in the Biden campaign. He certainly has made the transition. She's certainly listening to him. That Georgia tour, that Georgia bus tour with Tim Walz clearly was a Quentin Folks idea, and I think it's a good one. All right, we're going to get out of Indiana and go to the state of Washington. Jake in Everett, Washington. Asked, the amount of coverage and commentary dedicated to Kamala's sorority and the Divine Nine has been significant. Do you think this is helpful focus area for the campaign surrogates to continue to focus on? Not especially. If I were to list, the 47 things they should focus on, that wouldn't make it. It may be fine for some people, but I mean, obviously the black women are a critical force to come out in huge numbers. My guess is most of those black women voters didn't belong to a sorority at a prestigious university.
I think that's kind of part of who she is.
I'm not saying deny it.
I understand. In the black female sororities, they tend to be very tight. All right. You're right. This is not a thing that's going to be that expansive, but to show black women are very much more into sisterhood than I think. I don't get racial here, I don't mean to that, but they're more into sisterhood than maybe white males are into brotherhood. It's just that some of the foundational relationships they have is really something to see. But I agree, but I just think that's really kind of part of her DNA. Sometimes in politics, politicians do something they just want to do. Maybe this is that case.
I don't think it does any harm. The question was, should it be a big focus? And I think not. I agree with you on the sisterhood. This is a similar question, but it's got a different ending for you to pick up on, James. And it's Joe in Dobbs Ferry, New York, who says, aren't Democrats better off not wasting resources in Florida and Texas? But then the final part is instead going all in to get John Tester reelected to keep control of the Senate.
So, I appreciate the question. We've discussed this at length. There's so much money that you can spend in Montana.
Right.
Okay. My guess is, I love Senator Tester. I love his campaign. I love Shelby Donick. I love everything about it. But if Senator Tester gets beat, it's not going to be because of a lack of money.
Right.
Okay. you know, like I said, I wouldn't tell somebody where this minute, but Florida and Texas is a difficult decision that, you know, Democrats at Senate level and the national level are going to have to cope with, because I don't think you're going to change. I think you're in spitting distance in both states. But the risk of going in and the amount of money you spend, it would, you know, take away from North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, maybe, you know. It's a tough question. I'll just leave it at that.
It's a tough question, I agree, but my inclination, and by the way, there's not a trade-off here. What national Democrats do in Florida or Texas doesn't affect how much support John Tester gets in Montana. Shane said he's going to get everything he needs out there.
Right.
I think it's a tough question, but I think I don't find the answer that tough. If you have X amount of resource on whatever it is, October the 10th, and the choices between Florida or Texas versus, say, North Carolina and Arizona, I'd go the latter.
This is something I've always thought in politics, and some people say it's irresponsible. You're going to have resources. Fucking spend them. The money's coming in like water.
Oh, absolutely.
All right? It just is. It's just like, so just plow ahead, and, you know, the big donors are back, the little donors are back, the new donors are back. And I've never been, every time I go to one of these campaign schools they'd send you to, they would tell you how to budget backwards from Election Day. And I'll never forget, 1991, right after Labor Day at Harris Wofford, I said, fuck it, spend money like it's water. We just got to bet on the come here. And there's so many different ways to have money. The campaign has, what did they raise, $240
million? They got $540
million. $540 million?
Yeah.
Shit. In all of the ancillary groups, Senate Majority Pack, the House, the DCCC, us at Bridge and Ford Freedom or something. If people are raising money like it's water, just go out and spend the shit.
Yeah.
Just plow, 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 plow.
Well, the other group that has money, which comes to the question that Dave in Lake Lotawana, Missouri, we ought to check it out because Dave is a congressional candidate there. And he says, what are the chances the numerous state abortion questions on the ballot across the country could drive turnout and affect the outcome in congressional and presidential races in states like mine, Missouri? It's a perfect storm brewing, he asks. Boy, it is going to affect. That's what abortion does. It brings out voters. And it brings out, if you ask, Jim Gerstein will tell you, if you ask voters, what is one issue, which if the other person, if one person has the wrong answer, you would not vote for that person. And abortion far and away dominates that among people who are potential swing voters. Brings out voters. It's on, I think, 10 state ballots, James. Could make a huge difference in Arizona, could make a big difference, even in a place like New York. In 2022, New Yorkers kind of assume, well, yeah, Roe was repealed, but we have a very protective law here in our state, so it really doesn't affect us. And I think Democrats are trying to drive home the fact, because, you know, we want to enshrine this. We want to make sure the feds can never come and overcome this. I think it's going to help a little bit with turnout. In a place like Missouri, Dave, if you are running in Missouri or anybody else, I don't know what your district is like, but I really think abortion, that referendum, could add 2 or 3 points in various places.
So this is the most potent issue I've seen. Maybe some people say 9/11 didn't really help Republicans. It did till it didn't. But I've never seen an issue like this. We literally have not lost a race since Dobbs. I mean, just in every time that just goes to post, voters are for it. Of course, we talked about how Trump is trying to have it both ways, how the pro-life people are the pack of hypocrites. And you got them on the run. And I'm going to get some research done on how many current Republican House members have endorsed the Human Life Amendment. What was the Republican platforms? How many years that they have an anti-abortion plank in the platform. Because the big thing is, they're trying somehow or another to figure out how to navigate this terrain. So you kind of hear them say, look, we think it's up to the states. I did with Dan Crenshaw, I did Bill Maher. He said, look, the only two bills that we ever introduced, and they were two kind of innocuous things. And so their message is, look, it's not a big deal. And that is not true. People in New York, California, the theory was in 2022 that they didn't feel threatened by this because they thought the legislature would protect them. But we've now come to realize that there's a lot for them to feel threatened about, and we should remind them of why they should be threatened.
Yeah, I think that's right. James, the final question, I apologize to everyone whose questions we didn't get to. Send them in and we'll try again next week. John in Sonoma, California, says, this is not a normal election. There's only one issue, John says, before us in November, and that's the survival of democracy and the rule of law. Isn't it best for Kamala and Walz to be as vague as possible on policy and focus on that?
Well, first of all, you're right. Okay. That's what's at stake in this election. There's no doubt about that. But what's the most effective way to go forward with this, and that's probably got to talk about the rule of law and democracy. That by winning the election, you save the rule of law and you save democracy. I'm not sure talking about that in an election is the best way to win the election, although it happens to be true. There are any other things which are demonstrably true that may be of more benefit in an electoral campaign, but what you say, I don't doubt it. And where I see it manifest itself is, and ask yourself this question, should the press, should people like treat this, well, yeah, one candidate says something, other candidate says something else, this is where it is, then you have a little fact check thing and it says, well, this is actually wrong. Or do you treat this like what I think it is a battle to save the country? We were not objective in World War II. I'm sorry. It was not objective journalism. There was a bad side and a better side. And that was pretty clear. And, you know, going forward, we're going to have to figure out, and people who cover this are going to have to figure out what's the role of the sort of impartial arbiters in our society. And that's one that we need to bring up and think about and talk about.
Yeah, and I would advise people like the aforementioned Tom Cotton to at least read the statements of Michael Luttig. Michael Luttig is a conservative icon, appellate court judge, almost named to the Supreme Court. There was no conservative jurist who they admired more, other than perhaps Scalia. And he is endorsing Harris. He said, I may disagree with most of her positions, but this is about preserving democracy and the rule of law. It is a challenge. Please keep those letters coming in because we so appreciate them. And as I said, any we don't get to this week, we'll certainly try to get to next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Remember, get your tickets for when James and I take Politics War Room live to the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 19th and to the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta, Georgia on October 12th. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour, and we can't wait to see you there. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Miracle Made, and our episode show notes. We really thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are always adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review
And we will be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room plan.